The recently passed farm bill may lead to more logging on national forest lands. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you the status of a controversial proposed mining tunnel near the Smith River. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a trapper and a trapping opponent about the proposed initiative to ban trapping on public lands. The recently passed federal farm bill includes a process allowing state governors to nominate certain at-risk landscapes as a greater priority for forest management. Governor Steve Bullock has nominated over 5 million acres of Montana forest land for this new restoration program. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the program may speed up the permitting process for these lands.
A crane operator outside of Deer Lodge plucks from a constantly replenishing line of logs, feeding the logs onto another track heading into a mill. Sun Mountain Lumber directly employs more than 300 people.
We're one of the 11 remaining large mills left in Montana.
Co-owner Sherm Anderson. But even though he has acres and acres, rows and stacks of logs, he says he and other players in the wood products industry are in survival mode.
Not because of the markets, but because of lack of adequate timber supply.
He says he's been buying timber from other states to meet his demand. It's frustrating for him, especially since some of the Forest Service land visible from his lumber yard is filled with an expanse of pine beetle-killed trees.
What we're looking at up here on the east side, that's all totally dead. Been killed some 7-8 years ago anyway.
He's had a proposal to harvest those trees in the approval process with the Forest Service for 7 years, too. He's running out of time before that wood is too far gone to use.
But too often those discussions and thoughtful science-based management plans never come to fruition.
Governor Steve Bullock chose Sun Mountain Lumber as the site to announce his priority areas for this new U.S. Forest Service program built into the Farm Bill.
Gives us the tools for states to play a significant role in the management of federal forests.
Over the last 2 months, the Bullock administration has identified over 5 million acres across the state they believe deserving of priority designation. These should be spots facing insect infestation or those where forest health or human safety could be compromised by severe wildfires. If approved by the Forest Service, projects on these priority landscapes would be subject to a much more streamlined review and approval process, such as far less involved environmental assessments. These projects could be timber harvest or restoration efforts. Montana Conservation Coordinator with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, Barb Sestero, says these priority landscape designations could help rebuild wildlife and fish habitats put at risk by years of fire suppression efforts.
You know, it costs money to fix culverts that are blocking fish passage or address roads that are dumping sediment into our streams.
One of the areas the governor is submitting to the Forest Service for approval is the tract of pine beetle-killed trees Sherm Anderson with Sun Mountain Lumber has been looking to harvest for years.
This is an optimistic step, just one.
The Forest Service will be looking at Montana's nominated landscapes and deciding whether or not to designate them as priority areas eventually, Governor Bullock hopes within 3 months. He says this could set Montana's forest management priorities for the next 15 years. I'm Dan Boyce reporting outside of Deer Lodge.
And in other news from around the state, a mining company is dropping its plans to dig a mile-long tunnel for a copper development project near the Smith River. Department of Environmental Quality spokesman Chris Sager says Tintina Alaska Corporation sent the agency a letter withdrawing its exploration license request for the Big Butte Copper Project. The DEQ previously approved the tunnel, which would produce a 10,000-ton bulk sample of rock for testing. In March, two environmental groups filed a lawsuit challenging the DEQ's decision. Jim Jensen of the Montana Environmental Information Center accuses Tintina of planning to use the exploration tunnel to conduct mining activities without taking the proper regulatory steps. Jerry Zieg of Tintina says the company still intends to pursue an operating permit for a mine after gathering additional data from less invasive exploratory drilling.
A former employee of a veterans center in Hamilton has been arrested by the U.S. Secret Service for threatening President Barack Obama and his family. The Ravalli Republic reports 43-year-old Dan Rochelle of Darby was arrested late last week on two federal charges. A veteran told federal agents and the Valley Veterans Service Center Board that Rochelle claimed he had trained his wife to assist him in an assassination attempt should the president ever come to Hamilton. The veteran said Rochelle had also threatened to, quote, smash his skull in. The Secret Service also investigated Rochelle in 2011 for threats against the president after his ex-wife reported that he had been stockpiling weapons and was going to kill her and another former wife. Court records say he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression.
Opponents of trapping hope to get enough signatures to get Initiative 169, which would ban trapping on public lands, on the November ballot. The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department reports there are between 5,000 and 6,000 trapping licenses sold annually. In 2012, those trappers caught 67,000 fur bearers, everything from beaver to wolverine. They also, unintentionally, caught an occasional dog and other non-targeted animals. In this feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with Tom Zanu of the group Trap Free Montana Public Lands, which is sponsoring the initiative, and Toby Walrath, who is president of the Montana Trappers Association. Walrath is also the author of a book on trapping called Wild Pride Montana, A Trapper's Journey.
I started trapping when I was very young. My grandfather was a trapper, and my father was a trapper, and now I have a young son, and he comes along with me, and I'm passing on my heritage to him.
And you trap mostly in the Bitterroot, or whereabouts?
I do. I live in the Bitterroot, and that's primarily where I do most of my trapping. That's correct.
And what do you trap?
Well, I try to take advantage of every trapping opportunity that I can. Primarily, I grew up trapping what trappers refer to as aquatic fur bearers, so beaver and muskrat and mink. Those are the things I really enjoy. It's what I did with my dad, and so that's the primarily what I trap. But I also like to get into the high country on public lands and trap marten. It's one of my favorite wintertime activities that I like to do.
And do you trap mostly to sell the fur, or do you trap also for population control and that kind of thing?
As a fur trapper, certainly there is a aspect there where I do sell fur, but I also keep a lot of fur, and I have it tanned, and I make garments out of it. One of the things that
For personal use, yeah.
One of the things I'm proud of is that a lot of the clothing that I wear actually comes from a renewable natural resource, and certainly I am actively engaged in the conservation of wildlife, and I do participate as a trapper and a hunter and an angler in the state of Montana, and these are all things that, like I said previously, certainly enrich my enjoyment of the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. There are very few trappers, I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that actually make a full-time living trapping, right? It's just not that lucrative.
That's correct. Trapping is a very time-intensive and expensive activity to participate in. Certainly the trappers that are making a full-time living at it are also actively pursuing the profession of nuisance wildlife control, where they would trap throughout the summer months to help homeowners and private business owners get exclusion from troublesome animals.
Like, and then, coyotes, for example?
Coyotes could be some examples. Beaver are another one that come up often that do impact public health and safety, and they need to be removed, and knowledgeable trappers are the first to be contacted by our game officials. And there are a lot of regulations that we must uphold, just like hunters do and anglers do. And some of them are for conservation reasons, and some of those regulations are for social acceptance reasons.
And you're also regulated on the kind of traps you can use.
There are traps that must be used in a certain way. That is correct. The body gripping type traps are designed to kill an animal as quickly as possible. Versus a foothold trap, which is designed to catch and hold an animal until the trapper arrives to either dispatch that animal or release it. In our regulations, we recommend a minimum of 48-hour trap check with a foothold trap, and that is also in alignment with our trapper education program that the Montana Trappers Association has had in place for about 27 years.
We're speaking with Toby Walworth, who's president of the Montana Trappers Association, and also here in the studio is Tom Janu, who's with Trap Free Montana Public Lands, and this is the group that is sponsoring Initiative 169, which would ban trapping on public lands. And Tom, listening to Toby talk about the heritage of trapping in Montana and the kind of regulations that trappers adhere to and also the ethical trapping practices that they follow. Why do you object to trapping on public lands?
I think the trappers are unaware of the overall damage they do to Montana's wildlife. I think individually, like Toby, many are ethical. They care very much about animals. They know lots about animals from the experiences I've had talking to them. However, traps today are really efficient, and it's very easy to over-trap.
And what do you mean when you say over-trap?
Traps of the populations are in danger of extinction or they're very low. An example are beaver. There was probably 250,000 beaver in Montana when Lewis and Clark came through, and there's maybe 25,000 now. And that has a huge effect on water storage in the mountains, spring runoff, riparian areas, and lots of other species, many of which are threatened or endangered, that are associated with riparian habitats.
The state, though, sees beaver as a species that needs to be managed and controlled.
And in some cases, that's true. They cause flooding mostly on the floodplains, and people shouldn't be building houses in the floodplains. But I don't think that's an important part of the issue. And our initiative allows for trapping by either public trappers or trappers like Toby to go in and solve problems if there are problems.
What about that, Toby? The initiative would allow for some trapping if it was deemed that a species needed to be managed by trapping on public land.
That's correct. The wording of the ballot measure would allow trapping in certain circumstances. Per the wording of the ballot measure as it's written now, I-169 states that if all non-lethal measures have been determined to be ineffective, then trapping can occur. Once that animal is trapped, according to the ballot measure, that animal must be incinerated or burned unless it can be used for some type of public benefit. Montana Trappers Association maintains that our fur bears are a renewable natural resource, very well and effectively managed by our wildlife management professionals, and in accordance with the Wildlife Society, the Association of Fish Wildlife Agencies, and the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, our fur bears are very well regulated and managed, and the idea that an animal is killed and then thrown into an incinerator or into a dumpster does not seem to align with the ethical practices that fur harvesters in our state would adhere to.
Tom?
The main thing is that it wasn't used as a income-generating thing, that the carcasses weren't sold for a profit. Otherwise, if it can be used beneficially, good.
You haven't mentioned a couple of things that I know members of your group do have concerns about in terms of trapping, so I want to bring those up. And one is that the notion that trapping is inhumane inherently.
Trapping is cruel. There's not a mandatory trap check, so animals can spend days out there in pain.
Toby, that's true. It's not mandatory that you check those traps. It's recommended that the traps are checked every 48 hours, but there's no regulation for that, right?
That is correct. In Montana,
why not?
That's a great question, and it's a very valid point. In Montana, there is a trap check requirement by law for wolves, 48-hour minimum, but for other species, there is not. And it is recommended to check your traps every 48 hours. It is not a legal requirement. However, if there is a law that you cannot trap in a way that will cause the wanton waste of any animal. And so that actually leaves a pretty big window for judgment from our game officials as to what constitutes wanton waste. So while we don't have a mandatory trap check requirement, we cannot trap in a way that would cause an animal to rot and not be used.
Would you argue that the bulk of animals who are trapped don't suffer?
I would argue that if we use the best available technology, we have identified the traps that are the most efficient and humane. And then along with that are techniques and baits to use or lures to use or the ones to avoid. If we use that collective group of information. And as wildlife professionals, as trappers, as a representative of my trapping community, I am a staunch advocate for using the most readily available and the most advanced trapping techniques and equipment. Tom's group opposes openly trapping. They say that trappers are inhumane barbarians. I argue that they are not. Trappers are very in tune with our environment. We love the outdoors. We know a lot about the animals, and we treat the animals with the absolute most respect. At the same time, we are harvesting those animals. There is no question we are in the forests, and we are consuming wildlife. We do it as hunters, we do it as anglers, we do it as trappers.
My question was, would you argue that the bulk of the animals who are trapped in Montana don't suffer?
I would argue that if we use the most recent advancements in trapping and techniques, that the animals will not suffer. And if I am going to say that I can shoot an elk and take and consume that elk, and I can shoot a coyote and consume that coyote in whichever way I choose under the auspices of our governing agencies, the taking of animals is a viable and necessary component of our wildlife management.
The difference, and Tom, you can chime in here, but I think the difference between trapping and hunting, of course, is you shoot an animal and supposedly it's an instantaneous death. You put an animal in a leg hold trap, and maybe or maybe not that trap will be checked within 48 hours. But for that 48 hours or longer, that animal is alive and trapped and may not be suffering in physical pain, but certainly is a very traumatic event for the animal. That would be different than taking a high-powered rifle out and shooting an elk.
There certainly are some differences there. However, if you look at trapping using a foothold trap, an animal that is captured and you as a trapper decide that that animal is not one that you want to take, you can release that animal. If you are hunting, and once you pull the trigger, that's it. If you hit your target, that animal is yours.
Tom, you want to chime into this discussion in terms of whether it's humane or not?
Yes. Well, again, there's no requirement to check the traps, and some trappers don't check them for a long time. You're not sure that the body gripping or body crushing trap is going to actually kill the animal. It might just get a leg or something else. The traps are baited frequently, and you're not quite sure what's going to get into the trap. And so not all the traps that you come and collect the animals from have the animals that you expect them to be. I don't know what percentage you have. Sometimes pets and stuff get caught in traps.
Certainly it is something that can happen. I won't say that it isn't. However, there are a number of ways to minimize the risk in on-target capture.
Toby, how worried are you that as more and more people in Montana live in the territory where you trap, and I realize that the initiative applies only to public land, not private land, but how worried are you that your industry is certainly coming under more criticism because people do move into your trapping territory, they do have dogs, or they come upon a trap with an animal in it that's been killed and they don't like the sight of that? That's probably a concern, I bet.
It's absolutely a concern. Certainly public image and our place within a multi-use philosophy of our public and private lands is certainly something that we are concerned about. I'm working currently on a trapper working group with the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and other members of the agricultural industry, some non-trappers, and we're trying to find ways to eliminate those risks. And certainly, it can only benefit everyone.
Tom, speak to the idea that trapping is part of Montana's heritage in terms of an outdoor activity. It's like hunting and angling and all of that.
The sentiment's changing. Trapping overall in Montana, as it's practiced now, is very destructive. People know the cruelty issues The economic issues are probably the most important. There is decreased habitat for a lot of animals. Having some like the lynx and wolverine near the endangered species lists allows the federal government to come in and tell businesses like mine, the mining industry, what we can do with the land. And they can say if it's important habitat, they can stop your operations. So that hurts Montana. Trapping is quite small, and what we're talking about is just on the public land.
Well, I have been speaking with Tom Genoux, who's with the group Trap Free Montana Public Lands. They're the group that is sponsoring Initiative 169, gathering signatures to get that on the ballot. It would ban trapping on public lands. And Toby Walrath, who is president of the Montana Trappers Association and a trapper himself. And Toby and Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies, becoming partly cloudy with highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect until 11 p.m. this evening for Liberty County. Tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 35 miles per hour. Tomorrow, look for sunny skies becoming partly cloudy. High should be 60 to 70 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 45 miles per hour in the afternoon and evening. And in southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly clear skies with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, it should be sunny becoming partly cloudy with highs in the 60s. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Northwestern Energy's proposal to buy back the Montana Power hydroelectric dams has run into some opposition. In Northwestern's analysis of what a reasonable price was that their customers should be willing to pay to get those renewable electric resources back, Northwestern looked at what the alternative sources of additional electric supply would cost in the future. Besides adding some additional wind electric generation, Northwestern assumed that the majority of additional supply would have to come from generators burning fossil fuels, either natural gas or coal. In analyzing those future costs of generating from fossil fuels, Northwestern assumed that the federal government would be fairly strictly regulating the emissions of carbon from such electric generators. That did not seem like a wild stretch. EPA had already published rules governing the carbon emissions from new fossil-fueled electric generators and will release rules for existing electric generators this summer. In addition, most electric utilities around the United States analyze alternative sources of electric generation doing exactly what Northwestern did. They assume that generators burning fossil fuels will face a cost penalty tied to carbon emissions. Many of Montana's political leaders, however, are skeptical of the scientific claim that human carbon emissions are causing climate change. Not surprisingly, those political leaders also oppose any such federal regulation of carbon emissions. This makes Northwestern's inclusion of the future cost of federal carbon regulation look like the utility is in cahoots with tree-hugging liberals to discourage the use of Montana coal and natural gas. Northwestern appears to have raised the price it was willing to pay for the dams by hundreds of millions of dollars because the dams would help customers avoid the costs of future regulation of carbon emissions. As a result, Northwestern's customers would have to start paying higher electric prices right away if the dams were purchased, even though the fight over regulating carbon emissions is far from over. Those who do not believe that carbon emissions are a problem, this is quite galling. They see political beliefs that they do not agree with being incorporated into the price that would be foisted off on customers if those hydroelectric dams were purchased. To evaluate this debate, it may be helpful to turn Northwestern's electric supply decision on its head. Suppose instead of proposing to buy those hydroelectric facilities, Northwestern was proposing to the Montana Public Service Commission to build a new large coal-fired plant in eastern Montana at a cost of $1 billion. Assume further that Northwestern's management was highly skeptical of the claim that human carbon emissions threaten climate stability. As a result, the new coal-fired plant was not designed to capture any of its carbon emissions. Should the Montana Commission embrace such an electric generator, quickly approve making customers responsible for that billion-dollar cost, and cheer the fact that more Montana coal would soon be mined? One would hope that some hard-nosed, no-nonsense Montana conservative would say, just a minute here. If you build this plant, will you be allowed to operate it? We do not want customers to pay $1 billion for an electric generator that cannot get the permits to operate. Even if this cautious conservative Montanan thought that coal-fired electric utilities were currently overregulated, she might still say, it doesn't matter what I wish were the case. What matters in deciding whether to invest in this electric generator is what emission regulations are in place or will be in place in the future. Building a coal-fired generator is not a political statement. It is an important economic decision. In that setting, should the Montana Public Service Commission really burden electric customers with a billion-dollar engineering marvel that might not be allowed to operate unless another $1 billion was spent adapting it to meet the emission standards that will be in place when it comes online? It seems clear that the Montana Commission, like any regulatory commission around the nation, would reject such an imprudently designed electric generator, regardless of what the individual commissioners thought about human-caused climate change. But it is important to realize that the very reason for rejecting such a new coal-fired generator is the same as the reason for putting a higher value on the Montana hydroelectric facilities that Northwestern is proposing to buy in the name of its customers. Those hydroelectric facilities are more valuable because they do not burn fossil fuels, but instead rely on rain and snowfall and the forces of gravity. They represent an insurance policy against the costs of future regulation of the emissions caused by burning fossil fuels. Electric utilities across the nation are shying away from coal-fired generation, not because they do not like it, but because it is too risky financially because of the high level of air and water emissions associated with it and the increasingly strict and costly regulation that follows those emissions. Electric generating resources that do not have the same costly problems associated with the combustion of fossil fuels are economically more valuable because of that. That is not politics talking. It is cold, hard economics. Ignoring that would be both imprudent and costly.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.